an important way in which people learn and are persuaded to try something new is actually our friends and neighbors, right? So social learning is a really important vector by which new information gets transmitted, new behaviors become popular and spread widely.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Many of us think of influencers as people on YouTube or Instagram who convince us to buy a different type of lipstick. But in parts of the world in which reliable information's hard to come by, learning from people you can trust is a vital way in which important ideas travel. But how does social learning work, and how can we make it work better to improve the lives of people in developing countries? An experiment among farmers in Malawi gives us some important clues. Mushfiq Mubarak of Yale was one of the economists who conducted this experiment. Mushfiq, welcome to VoxDev Talks.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about the importance of agricultural production, maize in particular, in Malawi's economy.
Malawi remains an agrarian nation like many low-income countries around the world. So about 80% of the population still lives in rural areas and they depend on agriculture. And so it accounts for about a third of their GDP. And so within agriculture, both production and, policy decisions are dominated by the maize sector. More than half of all Malawians still receive their primary calories from maize.
And I was surprised to learn that innovations in seeds and fertilizers, for example, are adopted slowly, if at all, in agriculture in places like Malawi. Is it typical of the situation in a developing world?
Yes, unfortunately it is, although we now know that the situation has changed a lot in the last 50 years. So I think the most important story in the history of development, especially in South Asia, is the story of the Green Revolution. So when I was growing up in Bangladesh, say in the 80s, one of our main concerns were about food security. So lots of television talk shows that were talking about, we have 100 million people at the time in a population the size of a small US state. We're struggling to feed these people, and the population's projected increase to 150 million. How on earth would we feed all these people? Mm. And so today, that has happened. The population now stands above 150 million, but food security has ceased to be a concern. And the reason it's stopped being a concern is that agricultural productivity increased twofold, even threefold in some areas. And that's what the Green Revolution was about. So it was massive technology diffusion. The specific stories are things like, there are technologies that are maybe more drought resistant or flood resistant that allows you to now have two or three crop cycles on the same piece of land. And that's how you get a lot more food off of the same land area. But even technologies that proved to be immensely profitable like that, it took like 30, 40 years for it to take hold. And the welfare consequences of speeding up that process, if it had taken 10 to 15 years rather than 30 or 40, that would have been enormous. So Asia went through this pattern of slow technology diffusion, or I would say puzzlingly slow technology diffusion. Now, in Africa, that problem still remains. So technology adoption has remained low in Africa relative to all other continents. Agricultural productivity has also remained much lower and quite flat over the last 40 years relative to other continents.
But like many other countries, Mushfiq, Malawi uses government-employed extension workers to try to convince farmers to use these modern technologies, the seeds, the fertilizers. Are these policies not working?
For many countries, these policies have worked, but it's been uneven. So, even in the United States, there's been a big tradition of agricultural extension from over 100 years ago. These policy interventions are important. It's good that government agricultural ministries have a component of agricultural extension. So reaching out to farmers and talking about new technologies and teaching them how to use it, etc. But even in Malawi, where unemployment rate is very high, you see that about half of all these extension positions remain unfilled. And one reason, I think, is that to be effective in this particular way, you have to go, an extension officer has to go out and live in a remote rural area, because only if you're there with the farmers and you have lots and lots of contact and steady, consistent contact, can you really, persuade them well to adopt new technologies and teach them how to do it. But for a college-educated person, it's a very difficult proposition to say, you need to go out in a remote rural area, talk to farmers, and convince them to adopt. So, this is a person who might have a spouse who needs a job. It's not easy to get a productive career in this remote rural area. You need good schools for your children, right? So people are not highly attracted to these jobs. And even if they take those jobs, they remain in the city and therefore have very limited contact. Those are some of the very practical challenges of relying only on extension workers. And pair with that, the insight that's come out of sociology, economics, even computer science these days, that an important way in which people learn and are persuaded to try something new is actually our friends and neighbors, right? So social learning is a really important vector by which new information gets transmitted, new behaviors become popular and spread widely. And so I guess the question here is, can we enhance the government's extension efforts by using some innovations and ideas from social learning?
For decades, economists have assumed a model by which these technologies would spread passively, organically, if you like, from farm to farm. Does it happen like that?
Yes. So these insights from sociology, economics I've been talking about is really work of many, many scholars and early work back in the 1950s by Everett Rogers, who's a sociologist, by Zvi Grilicus, who's an economist who studied hybrid corn adoption among farmers in Iowa in the United States. That suggests that technology does passively spread from farm to farm, right, because of the social learning. The question, though, is whether we can do better. And again, the question here is about the speed of diffusion. So if we now have all these insights from scholarship in various fields that there is social learning, people do look to their neighbors. Now the question becomes, can we now activate that social learning rather than just rely on that slow passive diffusion? And can we activate it as a policy tool and use it to as a weapon to spread new technologies and speed up the diffusion of those new technologies?
Now, to do this, you've tried an experiment in which you recruited local farmers to influence other farmers to adopt this technology faster. What sort of farmers were you recruiting?
So this is work joint with Ariel Benishai, who's at the College of William and Mary. And we ran these experiments in partnership with the government of Malawi, with their Ministry of Agriculture. We worked in about 120 villages across 8 districts in the north, south, center of Malawi. We said, okay, let's try and introduce some new innovations from the social learning literature to enhance the agricultural extension process, the process of communicating with farmers. In one set of villages, it was a status quo. Let the extension worker do his or her job as he or she normally would. In another set of villages, we introduced this concept called lead farmers, which is a concept that was already, you know, the agricultural ministry was already, of course, familiar with, but also trying to use in a here and there without, you know, not in a systematic way. But we tried to systematize the process of identifying the lead farmers and giving them the responsibility to teach others. So first, we would identify lead farmers, teach them about a new technology, how to use it, and ask them to take on the role of teaching others. So who are these lead farmers? So these are people who usually have high social status in their village. These are people others look to. These are the people who normally have, you know, more land and are usually the ones who are first to try out new ideas. The problem with the lead farmer model, right, that we could anticipate at the time of setting up this intervention experiment, is that these lead farmers, by their very nature, are atypical. And they're doing something new, that's not particularly persuasive for everybody else, right? Just because some rich person in my village does something doesn't mean that's the thing I should be doing, right? Because there might be differences in his or her constraints and conditions and type of land, type of agricultural machinery they use versus me. And therefore, in another set of villages, instead of lead farmers, we identified what we call peer farmers. So kind of average looking farmers who represent different social groups in the village, and gave them the responsibility instead to teach others by first teaching the technology to them.
What sort of incentives did you give to these farmers?
This was all, again, done experimentally. So there's a question of whether or not when you are providing somebody the responsibility to partner with you and teach others something and spend their time and effort doing so, like, do they need to be provided some reward for doing it? It could go either way. So one is that, of course, the standard economics tells you that people might put in more effort with incentives. But on the other hand, there are concerns from the behavioral economics literature and psychology literature that it might undermine intrinsic motivation and therefore actually get in the way of people's effort. And most importantly, the concern that we had is that, look, if I were to tell you, let's say you and I are friends, and I tell you, look, I just bought this new Samsung phone, and it works well, maybe you should try it too. Given that you and I are friends, and we use our technology for similar purposes, you might find that message convincing. But now, if you hear that Samsung paid me a little bit to pass on that message to you, then you may not take me as seriously. So incentives may also undermine the credibility of the messenger. Because of all these concerns, we decided to experiment with it. So in some areas, in for half the communicators, we provide incentives, and in the other half not. And the incentives themselves were really small. It was like a bag of fertilizer for lead farmers, and for each of the peer farmers, it was a bag of legume seeds. And the reason we did it this way is that there were multiple peer farmers, because, you know, they represented different social groups. And so we wanted to keep, in every village, our communication strategy, we wanted to keep it budget neutral from the perspective of the government.
So how well did your experiment work? Did you manage to speed up, increase learning?
So now, having described the experiment, so there were at least six arms to think about. So there are these three different types of communicators. There's the status quo, the extension worker-based communication. There's a lead farmer-based communication, and then there's a peer farmer-based communication. So three communicator types, and half of each type has an incentive or not. So three times two creates these six arms. After running these interventions, we tracked these farms for the next two more agricultural seasons, so three seasons in total. We decided to track learning outcomes at the end of the first year in the next agricultural season, and then actual adoption at the end of the second year. So learning outcomes were things like, you know, just going back into these villages and essentially in the middle of our surveys, giving people tests. So take a random set of farmers, give them tests about what they know about the technologies that we introduced. So for example, one technology was something called pit planting. It was more popular in West Africa and relatively new in Malawi. But in addition to telling people about pit planting, we had to teach them about sort of the appropriate spacing between the pits, how many seeds, maize seeds should be put in each pit. So pit planting is just like digging little pits, putting maize seeds in there. The reason to do this is that these are very arid areas in Malawi. If you dig pits and plant maize that way, like more of the soil moisture gets retained, and it's the retention of moisture that increases productivity. And we do see huge increases in productivity associated with pit planting. What we find is that at the end of the first year, learning did significantly increase in some arms. And at the end of the second year, we see actual adoption. This is a new technology, so nobody was doing pit planting, almost no one was doing pit planting. But by the end of the second year, in one of our arms, pit planting rates went up to about 13-14%, which is, going from 0 to 14 is actually quite a remarkable achievement in 2 years, given the history of technology diffusion. And for another technology, composting, a new type of composting that we introduced, the adoption rates did go up by about 25 to 30 percentage points. Which of these strategies work? Now, it turns out, you know, this peer farmer strategy, if you don't provide the incentives, the peer farmers do absolutely nothing. So basically, you know, when we go back a year later, the peer farmers themselves, we also tested them. They themselves don't remember anything about the technology. They didn't bother taking it up. They didn't talk to anybody else about it. And so in those villages, the technology just died out. However, when we add those little incentives, and they were really cheap incentives, like a bag of legume seeds per peer farmer, so they felt like we were appreciating their effort and they were receiving a reward for it, conditional on some effort and performance, they jump from number six, the worst case, to the best case. Peer farmers with the incentives, we observed the largest gains in both learning and then in technology adoption.
Does that mean that the intervention can pay for itself because it's quite cheap?
Yes. So even accounting for our data collection costs here, the intervention in our particular case did pay for itself. But we have to be wary of the fact that, you know, when you provide incentives, that's costly. It's not that the intervention itself is costly, like a bag of fertilizer, bag of legume seeds. That's not very expensive, and it's perfectly reasonable to expect, say, a government agency to scale up. However, if you add performance-based incentives, if that's part of what makes this entire strategy work, then that gets expensive. This means that you have to monitor people's performance. And at the end of the 2 years, the government's reaction was, yeah, this all sounds great. The peer farmer, lead farmer models are great, and they have now scaled up those pieces. However, the incentive part and the monitoring part is the part where the government said, look, you guys had researchers going around different villages and monitoring performance, right? That's not something that's easy for us to do at scale, given our administrative capacities and constraints.
It sounds like you had this in 120 villages. It would be very difficult to scale it up to the whole of Malawi and beyond.
Yes, we do need to continue to learn along these lines in order to figure out these scaling issues. So first, this proof of concept that says, look, if I were to introduce insights from the social learning literature on how people learn, whether we can get them partners who can teach them, who should those partners be, we now see that there are some promising results that come out of that. But to sharpen our strategy for the purpose of scaling, we do need to find other alternatives to incentives. So here's an alternative we tried out in a second stage. So there was a second paper co-authored again with Ariel Benishai, with Laurie Beeman at Northwestern, and Jeremy Magruder, who's at UC Berkeley. We did not have performance-based incentives. We just gave people rewards for doing it. And we also changed the mechanism by which we sort of chose these peer farmers. So the idea here is, you know, one of the scaling issues that economists often worry about, or statisticians worry about, is the question of external validity. You know, I tried this experiment in Malawi, it worked. Who knows whether the same experiment would work elsewhere? Mm-hmm. Just as a simple example, I choose these peer farmers on the basis of a conversation with villagers. And if I have similar village meetings in India or in Peru, the same types of people may not come out as the peer farmers get chosen by the village. And it might be that they have different characteristics that may make them better or worse at training and teaching others and persuading others. Instead, what we try to do in the second project is, let's try and use information about scalable or consistent patterns in people's social networks in order to identify these peer farmers. Let's not rely on the specific social structure in Malawi, but let's collect data on who's connected to whom, right? Kind of do something called a network mapping, which is something one can do in India or Peru or anywhere else in the world. So we did that. Again, we see that there were, in some arms, there were much better technology adoption than others. And this network theory-based approaches can outperform the extension worker-based approaches. But here again, the next scaling question becomes, you know, this network mapping itself is a data-intensive exercise. That's not something that's easily scalable. How we end that research is to say, look, we do some modeling to show that it's possible to take advantage of those insights on the basis of only 5 to 7 interviews in a village. If you do it on the basis of only 5 to 7 interviews, you end up getting about 80-85% of the benefit in our simulations. And so those are the types of research areas that we need to push further on, which is, how do we import these insights to improve agricultural technologies? And second, how do we make them scalable?
Talking of external validity, could we do this for healthcare or nutrition instead of agriculture?
Yeah, in fact, we are doing it right now. So I've been working with the government of Bangladesh on our COVID response. I'm from Bangladesh and I do a lot of research there. So I have strong partnerships with people who are working there, including some government bodies. And as soon as COVID hit, it became clear to all of us that, look, we're not in the immediate term, we're not going to get a lot of testing done. And therefore, we need access to other types of data that allows us to make some indirect inferences about spread of COVID and how to devise the appropriate policies and response. And so we started doing phone surveys right away to gather data on people's symptoms, what they know about COVID, the stigma associated with the disease, their social distancing and hand washing and mask wearing behavior, et cetera, et cetera. While we started making these calls, I realized, you know what, we can also use some of these same phone calls to implement the same type of strategy that we did in Malawi with agricultural production. So just like we are asking people in the villages, the lead and the peer farmers, to partner with us to spread messages about new agricultural techniques, why don't we also do that with regular folks in Bangladesh to ask them to spread healthier messages about how to prevent COVID spread? And again, since we learned in Malawi that incentives were critical, one of the things that we started trying out here immediately is, should we be adding some phone credit? So we call people up and give them, let's say, good information about the disease that we'd like them to talk to others about. That's endorsed by the government and so forth. And we tell them, you know, and since you're doing this job for us of calling others and talking to them, we're going to send you some phone credit. So that was an easily scalable way for us to send the incentives out, which is by sending phone credit over the phone. And again, given the external validity concerns here, because we're moving to a different sector, a different country, right? We are experimenting with this a little bit to see what components of those strategies work best, so that the most scalable version and the cheapest version is scaled up by the government.
Well, it sounds extremely promising, very interesting. Mushfiq, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The paper we've been talking about is called Social Learning and Incentives for Experimentation and Communication. The authors are Ariel Ben-Yishe and Mushfiq Mubarak. It was published in the Review of Economic Studies, May 2019. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform and you will never miss an episode. Or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.